Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Matthew Witt. Matt is a University of Laverne, California, Associate Professor of Public Administration. His published works with others shows shadow governing entities and state crimes against democracy undermine America's legitimacy and founding doctrine. Matt, it's great to have you on. It's it was a number of weeks back you were on last. There is so much happening. I can't imagine where you want to begin. I can think of a dozen things I'd like to talk about, but let me let you jump into what is most on your mind.
Stephen, it's always a pleasure. I look forward to likewise what's on your mind. It's hard. Where to begin? There's, you know, sort of further developments in the Boston bombing. Sibel Edmonds is doing really, really fine work, cutting edge on that at Boiling Frogs. The Partnership for Civil Justice Fund is doing excellent work, pressing with FOIA requests to get disclosures from Department of Justice regarding the crackdown on Occupy. So there's new revelations about that. Lance David Smith's book came out recently, Conspiracy Theory in America, which is a remarkable piece of work, very exacting and precise and evocative analysis of how we arrived with this conspiracy theory meme. And how powerful it is for shaping and suppressing discussion and dissent in our country. I'd like to talk a little bit on these various points, but I'm these lead in all sorts of directions that are important to suss out. So as you have topics, likewise, let's mix it up.
Oh, well, I absolutely agree with you, Matt. I emailed you that I'm writing two articles today on Obama's speech yesterday. There's so much in it that really needs to be deconstructed and criticized. I absolutely see no change coming. This guy has been a serial liar from day one in office. I include him in my first article where I take him on myself. My second one is a media critique, and I take on the media because, for the most part, they're largely going along with what he said. I mean, this guy has literally lied from day one. I quote from a speech that he gave at the in May 2009. He talked about the bad policy of the Bush administration. He promised to change it. We need a new direction. We need fundamentally to do things differently than the way the past administration did for 8 years, and so on and so forth, Matt. And I quote him chapter and verse from what he said. And then you go to, then you take a look at what his policies have been, 4.5 years of office, and you go to the speech he gave yesterday. Well, nothing has changed. If anything, things have gotten worse. So anybody who would believe what he said yesterday, I just can't imagine where they're coming from. They simply don't know what's going on, what this guy has on his mind, who he's beholden to, and if they think it's going to change in the next 3.5 years, they're dreaming.
Yeah, they're dreaming. It's a very deep, it's a very deep sleep. I have a little anecdote on that, Stephen, I'd like to share with you, and perhaps we could develop further. I was recently away at a reunion with good friends of mine. We gather once a year up in Central Oregon. And they're friends from college days, and then others gathered along the way. And it's a men's gathering. And a beautiful area out there in Central Oregon, sort of high plains, semi-arid, scrub pine and pine and scrub forest, sage forest, Deschutes River passing through, and we have a place that's right on the river. And it's just, when it's not raining, it's absolutely stunning. And so we're having a good time there, we're loosening up, having some beers and so on, and we're going from the river to the hot tub and hanging out and chatting. And at some point, the discussion diverts to the 9/11 incident, not because of the incident itself, but as a point of reference. And so the couple fellows, good friends of mine, were discussing, you know, an event that had happened in their lives together, and that, oh yeah, it was right around the time of 9/11. And then there's sort of a grave tone that overcast to the discussion, and then that draws in sort of speculation about what that event signified and so on. Now, I know from previous discussions with one of these guys, a really close friend of mine, that it's a kind of, it's a very contentious point between us that I have suggested actually to this group several years ago that, you know, the evidence indicates that something very, very different from the official story must have happened. That there's no way that the sequence of events, not to mention the day of occurrence and the violation of laws of thermodynamics that the official account would have us believe, can possibly be true. Not in this universe. So only in a dream world could it be true. And, you know, they got very upset, most of them. This was about 5 years ago, six years ago. They got very upset and you know, scorning me and saying, how can you believe that? That's just right-wing hysteria and all of this. So now we're years later, and these guys know that I persist with this stuff, and we sort of agreed to not talk about it. And so I'm sitting there as the discussion comes up, and I decide, you know, these guys are close friends, and it's not worth it for me to, you know, be coming off sounding pedantic and all that. I'm just going to get up and leave. And I thought about that, and I had an email exchange actually with Lance David Smith on this, with whom I work closely. And it occurred to me that so much of our conventional morality, you know, about what we assume to be a socially appropriate dialogue, topics that are permissible, and even more insidiously, how we should be thinking about our lives and the world, are conditioned in a huge way by these forces that are ominous and way beyond us. And those, into that same source, of powerful source, goes all truth. You know, the truth is something that we can transact, as with William James and the pragmatists, you know, truth is something that we can transact meaningfully between us in the real present. It's not an absolute truth in an enduring sense, apart from how we can ground it between us and meaningfully between us. And then I'm sitting there and realize that, you know, in a profound, not so profound way, I've got to forsake that engagement with my closest friend and walk away. And you know, they will persist with their informed, very informed delusions about this critical event. And we, my dear friends, will not have a discussion about it. And I think this is replayed countless times in this country. And Lance does remarkable work. I think his book is destined to be a classic, actually. He does remarkable work plumbing the contours of this dynamic, this very, very worrisome dynamic. He talks about the conspiracy theory meme and the label, and how its target is not the speaker who speaks, you know, fearless speech towards power and says the king wears no clothes. In fact, the target of the scornful conspiracy theory meme is the audience. So the audience is conditioned to respond to anyone challenging the king's speech, as with you challenging Obama, with the scorn and dissension that is primed, it's preconditioned, because there's this deep taproot into our shared consciousness about what conventional morality determines for us. And since we are, you know, divested of deeper morality little by little, perhaps under conditions of empire more than ever, then the truth itself becomes a grave threat. You know, the engaging in that fearless search for truth is gravely threatening. And then research that I'm very interested in is the use of popular media, particular film, Hollywood in particular, as a primer for conventional morality. And there's been various sort of work in this and discussion about this and how powerful Hollywood is in shaping cultural norms, and particularly from the right wing, concern about the immorality of Hollywood storylines and so on. But I think much less analyzed is the extent to which there is priming by Hollywood to establish these cultural narratives that determine conventional morality around matters of truth-seeking. I don't mean truth-seeking in the sense of a sacred covenants and what the religious right wing holds dear. I mean the truth-seeking in the pragmatist sense, the William James sense, the John Dewey sense, their sense of a usable truth between people and within communities. And Hollywood and film watching is very much the theater of our time, or very much the church, a church-like cross between our church and the Greek agora and the Greek theater itself. It's a very, very, very important place for establishing mores in culture. So I'm beginning to look into that. But anyway, sorry, I drifted off, but that anecdote to me is powerful. And I think
It means a lot to me, Matt. I'll give you a very short anecdote. I can make it extremely short. My best boyhood friend I lost contact with for a number of years, and we reconnected around the time when Israel was waging its so-called Operation Cast Lead on Gaza, December 2008, January 2009. I wrote daily articles on it. I was unforgiving. I ripped Israel up one side and down the other, exposing its lawless imperialism and the great crimes of war and against humanity it was committing. I mean, the evidence was there in plain sight, and I couldn't believe the response I got from my best friend. He ripped me up one side and down the other. He basically said he never wanted to hear from me again. I was shocked. I mean, what it said to me was that here's a guy, a very intelligent guy, who should know better. He can get all the information I can get, but he doesn't do it. He believes that what's going on is really just policy, and if he did a little bit of due diligence, he'd know the opposite. And instead of doing that, he took out his wrath on me.
Stephen, I want to read you along those lines a passage from Lance's book, Conspiracy Theory in America, if I may.
Oh, absolutely.
He writes, page 164, and I think it's chapter 5, he writes, if the U.S. electorate were united in opposing conspiracies by the political class, most of the elite intrigues and duplicity in domestic politics would have ended long ago. But the truth is that many Americans support U.S. officials and institutions, even when they are implicated in anti-democratic conspiracies targeting U.S. policymaking. Simply put, there's an element in American society, perhaps a large element, that trusts the government to do what is best for the nation and that believes state manipulation of domestic politics, at least in relation to foreign affairs, is necessary, even though it is usually illegal. This group can be called conspiracy realists, not because they are more realistic than conspiracy believers or deniers, but because they base their political actions and attitudes on what they consider to be the existing realities of power. They speak as if they support the aspirations of the founders for liberty and popular control of government, but they are quite happy if the government secretly snoops on their neighbors to enhance their own security. Although few conspiracy realists would be familiar with the ideas of, for instance, Leo Strauss, their philosophy is Straussian in important respects. Conspiracy realists might reject some of the conclusions drawn in this book's analysis of SCAD patterns of 9/11 and the anthrax letter attacks, for instance, but this is not the key reason for their continued support of America's amoral national security elites. Their main considerations are that the government has information we lack. The agencies being accused of complicity in murder, treason, and other high crimes are essentially the same organizations, essentially the same organizations that led America to victory in both World War II and the Cold War using those very same tactics. And the growing availability of thermonuclear, biological, and chemical weapons of mass destruction exposes the U.S. to extreme and perhaps existential threats from any number of enemies. Conspiracy realists would want to protect what they see as the gains of the past decade, principal among them that America's national security elites and top elected officials have successfully shaped a new world order around the idea of a war on terror that allows the quote-unquote war on terror, that allows the United States to attack its enemies preemptively, despite the United Nations Charter provisions to the contrary. So he's coining this term, conspiracy realists.
Well, I would use the same notion, Matthew. I only believe in conspiracies that are real. the others I discount completely. There are too many of them that are real. 9/11. You know, the non-believers call it a conspiracy. You're part of consensus 9/11. The 9/11 event is officially reported, of course, as a bald-faced lie. We may not know 100% of the truth, but we sure know enough to know that what went on was entirely different and opposite of what authorities claim it is. And we could go on and name so many other things. There are lots of conspiracies that are real. They're not conspiracies at all.
When he says in this, what I take him to mean here with regard to conspiracy realists are the cynics. You know, they are those who are and I know many of these types of people. They concede the science. They accept that in this universe and its laws of thermodynamics, such as they are, that it's impossible that those towers came down as imputed by the official account. I know many people and an increasing number of people that accept that, Stephen. And so, you know, that's a sort of pirate victory, it seems to me, for truth. They accept it, but they're not going to talk about it. It's just the way of the world, and it is not an impetus to or challenge of them morally. It is simply the way things are, and Lance is construing from that these conspiracy realists, like realpolitik, as it were, Machiavellian cynics, that it is true and it's the way things should be, and it is good in the long run because of what David Ray Griffin calls sort of our tributes to our new national our new religion, which is nationalism. So we've replaced even the best of sacred devotions to a national religion that the United States has a godlike force on this planet. And so the realists are absolutely fine with that. So you and I are not conspiracy realists in Lance's formulation here. We are, along with Consensus 9/11 and a growing group of truth seekers, you know, conspiracy challengers. I don't know. I prefer sort of the truth movement. I like being affiliated with that because that gets us past conventional morality, and it puts to the lie, or brings to surface, as with what Lance, I take him to be doing, that this vast cynicism in this country that was evident with the Kennedy assassination, once that got muffled, and everyone, you know, it was a great deal. You're a bit older than me. It was a great deal that came out right away, very similar to the 9/11 incident with Kennedy's assassination, if not more, beginning with the magic bullet meme that had to be suppressed and was the result of the conspiracy theory formulation by Rand Corporation and assuring that the media picked that up, and he documents that well in his book, Lance's book. So I you know, this massive consent to accept this living lie, you know, is pretty ominous. You know, it's a lifestyle commitment over and above you know, something more, I'll say, sacred between humans and their relationship to all things.
Matter,
you know,
I agree with you entirely. You could go back years before the age of computers, and people had some reason to be less informed than they are now. Most people have a computer. I don't know what the percentage is in the country, but so many millions have a computer. They can go online and very easily get basic information to understand enough of what's going on, to know they're being lied to be their harm, being harmed by government policies, not just abroad, but domestically. You go back a century or so ago, and Walter Lippmann used the phrase of the bewildered herd, describing people who simply are out of touch and don't have any idea what's going on. Well, you know, maybe it was harder to be informed back then, but even then, people could do a little due diligence and know something. I mean, what are things that harm or can harm their well-being? If that's not incentive to want to find out what's going on so you can take action against it, I don't know what is, but most people don't do it. They hear the big lie repeated over and over again, and they buy it, and they still buy it today. They still turn on their TV sets, Matt, and think they're getting real news and information.
It's astounding, isn't it?
It's astonishing. It really is astonishing. It's the most agonizing thing I go through all the time. How do we convince people to do something to protect their own welfare? Their own welfare, not mine, not yours, not the guy down the street. Their own welfare, their family, their children, their grandchildren. Don't they care about those things? Apparently not, from the way they act.
It's a remarkable question. It's, you know, because you're asking, oh, well, of course I care about my family. And in fact, early discussions with my closest friends made clear that, you know, they were very, very worried that they would be become objects of surveillance if they talked further to me about this issue. They were very, very worried. And, you know, it wasn't that they didn't have affection for me. It wasn't that they're delusional in their day-to-day lives, not that they're dissociative, right, or anything like that.
I can appreciate their concern, Matt. I mean, we live in a mass surveillance society. I mean, they come on at our emails, our snail mails. They can bug our telephones. They watch us on the streets when we go shopping, when we go to work, probably in the bathroom. They can watch us everywhere. They can listen. They can look. They can do what they want. And the stuff that I do all the time, Matt, I can't imagine that I'm not being monitored. They're probably listening to this program right now. I like to joke and say if my CIA and FBI friends would simply give me an email contact address, I'll save them the trouble of monitoring. I'll CC them on everything I do. I will do it. I'll add them to my very short distribution list.
It's very likely they've got someone monitoring this right now, and that person's, you know, got a Game Boy in front of him, and you know, until some code word we say pops up, he won't count it on his checklist.
I even wonder, Matt, whether they can watch me on video. I do Skype interviews, Skype video on TV, and I've got to turn on the camera to get it to work. But I'm wondering if they can watch me with the camera off.
I've wondered that too. It's remarkable what they have at their disposal, the little bit that we know. Right?
I wrote something, it's been some time ago, and we're getting short on time, and I want to let you finish up. Oh, it goes back maybe 4 or 5 years now, but I wrote something about the state-of-the-art technology where some kind of satellite-based technology can literally see through concrete walls and stuff like that, so you could be in some kind of a windowless structure, wood, concrete, whatever, and the technology can penetrate it and watch what you're doing. Now, whether that's accurate or not, I have no idea, but it's scary.
Leonard Cohen has a wonderful, the singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen, he was a poet at one time, poet laureate of Canada, and his song, The Future, written in the 90s, early 90s, I think, is remarkably prophetic about what you're bringing up here. Anyway, it just struck me, the lyric. There's some really powerful lyrics there.
Oh, there is so much. There is so much going on, and I've said it on this program and discussed it with other people in, of my generation, that we can look back at an earlier time, Matt, and things were far from perfect. America always had warts. My goodness, I mean, its whole history is wart-filled. But you think about what's going on now, and I've used the phrase, and I've repeated it a number of times, that I absolutely believe we're living through the most perilous time in world history. We literally have the power to destroy the Earth, maybe in a day or less. And the idea that we won't have a nuclear war is an idea that that cannot be discounted. The possibility is very real. And Hyman Rickover, three decades ago, in testifying to Congress, said so. Whenever nations go to war, and maybe they're evenly matched, they'll use every single weapon they have. History reflects that. So if we ever got into a conflict with a nation that could really fight back, and if they had nuclear weapons, or even if they didn't, you would see nuclear bombs flying. And if that happens, it could be curtains. I mean, I don't know that it'll happen, but the possibility is real. Doesn't anybody think about these things?
You know, I get back to how we started our discussion, which is, you know, people want to, you know, love their families and do right by their church communions and their church communities and communions. They want to, you know, get on with, you know, their lives. And we mere mortals are not up to these matters. I mean, it's almost the level of sort of Greek tragedy and epic, Stephen, that the gods govern, you know, and that a few of us mortals who have greatness are tested, and that becomes saga. And, you know, the Greeks didn't have nuclear arsenals. You wonder what they would have written if they did. You know, how their contemplation of the crucible of character and the great man would take shape under those conditions. Now, I think the closest we've come biographically to a great man in those conditions, regardless of his fallibilities, was John F. Kennedy. And he clearly glimpsed the perils that you're articulating here. He clearly glimpsed them. And the initiatives he took to disarm for in face of the peril of annihilation of civilization, you know, that's what led to his death.
Absolutely, Matt. We are just about out of time. I must say, I may have mentioned on the program before, as a senator, he was my commencement speaker in 1956. I think he was killed because he wanted to wind down the Vietnam War. He wanted to end the Cold War. He wanted to do things that a responsible leader should do. He didn't start off that way in his administration, but he came around at least to some extent, and he really wanted to do some important things that were right, and I think that's why he was murdered.
I think history indicates, no question, that's why he was murdered. That's why Martin Luther King was murdered. Yeah. That's why any number of great people have been vaporized one way or the other.
Bobby Kennedy too.
The gods, as it were, see to it, whoever they are.
It's a terrible state of affairs, man. We really are out of time, and I'm expecting to hear the ending music momentarily. We are out of time, but we really do live in a hugely dangerous time. And if people don't get aroused to realize the possibility that their end times may be closer than they think, it will end up being too late to matter when they do awaken. But literally, it scares the dickens out of me. Matt, I look forward to having you back again. I've got to sign off. I'll remind listeners to tune in over the weekend at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and I hope they'll all make it a regular habit.